Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by former AFGE FEMA Local President Leo Bosner, AFGE Federal Law Enforcement Steering Committee Secretary Treasurer Jim Aldridge, and Vinnie DeMarco, President of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative and the subject of a new book, The DeMarco Factor. Welcome to Inside Government, Leo.
Thank you, Ward.
Well, let's talk about how you first got involved in working for the federal government. How did you start?
Well, I hadn't thought of it, working for the federal government. When I was 19, I dropped out of college back in the 60s, joined the Army, did a year in Vietnam, the 101st Airborne, and got out of the Army after 3 years, went back to college on the GI Bill, and eventually landed in Washington, D.C., and got a job at the General Accounting Office. And my first week there, I got my pay stub, and it said 3 years of federal service. So I was kind of in a panic. I called the payroll, and I said, excuse me, I only started last week. Why did it say 3 years? And he said, well, you were in the Army for 3 years. So I said, well, hey, that's pretty cool. So that worked out okay. It was a GAO for a short time, then went to Housing and Urban Development and Flood Insurance. That office was subsumed into FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, in the fall of 1979. Which is when I joined FEMA, and I was in FEMA from October of 79 until I retired in January of 2008.
So, needless to say, you've had a pretty long career in FEMA. You've worked a number of different places within the agency?
Yes. I worked originally in FEMA has a number of different functions. We try to prevent disasters, or try to prevent disaster damage through flood insurance and by mapping floodplain areas, encouraging people not to build houses in flood-prone areas. I worked in flood insurance for a while. I worked in state and local guidance for a while, helped write a guidebook for state and local officials on emergency preparedness, eventually wound up in federal response planning, and then finally wound up as a GS-14 watch officer in FEMA's National Response Coordination Center, which is where I was working toward the end there and where I was working when Hurricane Katrina came in.
So let's go back. It's been about 5 years now, I guess, since Katrina, and you really played a lead role in that. Tell us what was going through your mind when you first saw there was a storm down there in the Gulf.
Well, actually, what was first going through my mind is my wife and I were down at DuPont Circle. It was one of my days off. It was the Friday before Katrina came in. Katrina hit on a Monday. And it was Friday afternoon. We'd gone to an art show and bought a few souvenirs and things, and we were walking around there. And my cell phone went off, and it said, we're being activated here. You're due to come in. There's a hurricane coming in. They didn't say the name of it. There's a hurricane coming in. You're activated for night shift starting tonight. So my wife and I went on home and made myself my sandwiches and coffee and things and went into work the night shift that night. That would have been Friday, I think the 25th of August. And from there on, I was working on the night shift for the next 2 months. We got occasional lights off because it was Katrina and then Rita and then Wilma. So really three hurricanes in a row. Our concern when we went in that night, this is the National Response Coordination Center at FEMA, which is FEMA's disaster headquarters here in Washington, where FEMA and all the other federal government agencies and the Red Cross all come in to coordinate together in large disaster. And as we on that Friday night, as we saw the news and saw the hurricane coming in on the weather from the National Weather Service, we gathered statistics on New Orleans. Our job on the night shift is to gather all this information and have it ready first thing in the morning for the executives when they come in, the heads of Homeland Security, the Defense Department, FEMA, and so on, so they can make the decisions and they can move quickly. So we gathered information during the night. The people who are working for me did an excellent job. And as we do at 5:30 every morning, we turned out something called the National Situation Report, which FEMA produces at 5:30 a.m. every day of the year, including Christmas and New Year's. And we gave a very strong warning on the incoming hurricane, pointed out that a lot of people might not be able to evacuate. They might not own cars. This was a serious situation coming in. And then it was Saturday morning at 7 a.m. We'd been working all night. We all went home, turned it over the day shift, and we all went home to get a good day's sleep, confident that the preparation was coming, that food and water and medicine would be quickly mobilized and staged and ready to send down to New Orleans. That Saturday night, we came in for our next shift, and all of us were pretty shocked that not much had happened. A few teams were on alert. A few executives had flown down. We said, wait a minute, this is like a giant bowling ball rolling toward you, and you're saying, well, we'll put a few teams on standby. We'll send a couple of executives down. the large actions that should have taken place hadn't taken place. So Sunday morning, we put out another situation report. We really stressed how serious the situation was. But again, not much really happened. So Monday, the hurricane hit, and then the levees failed, and the rest is history.
Well, let's back up a little about the status of the agency. Now, you had obviously been there for, you know, over two decades, mm-hmm. you know, worked in the merit system, worked around the agency. Had you noticed any changes in how the agency operated between, say, the 1990s and by 2005?
Yeah, and actually going back a little further, if you recall, during the 1980s, when FEMA was first established, we hadn't had any big disasters in the U.S. for a long time. And FEMA back then was known as a dumping ground for incompetent political appointees, incompetent executives. And in 1992, Hurricane Andrew hit Florida, and FEMA basically was sitting around with no good plans, no response plans or anything. People were outraged. Clinton was then shortly after elected president, and in the 1990s, FEMA improved dramatically. We had a director, James Witt, who came in, who understood that the employees were the ones who worked for him. They were the ones who had to do the job. He respected and supported the employees. He supported training for people, trained people to work on disaster teams. And in the 90s, I would say that FEMA was one of the most effective and one of the best agencies in the federal government, not just from the employees' point of view, but in 1995, we were all at work one morning when I looked at the television. Sorry, it's a little emotional sometimes. We looked at the television screen and the bomb had gone off in Oklahoma City, killing all those people. We mobilized and sent search and rescue teams to Oklahoma City within, I think, 2 hours of that event. There was no warning. There were no weather maps. There was nothing. Within 2 hours of that incident, we were in touch with Oklahoma. We were in touch with the region, and search and rescue teams were being mobilized and sent out there. And that was how it was in the 90s. And then when the new administration came in, well, with Hurricane Andrew, with Hurricane Katrina, we had 2 days' warning and couldn't seem to get it together.
And, you know, I remember after the fact seeing things over the internet people would send out saying, well, there are all these school buses. Why didn't the mayor mobilize the school buses and take everybody out? But I mean, from what I'm hearing from you, I mean, you guys at the national headquarters had access to the National Weather Service. This is what you all do professionally. You know, you have a better ability, I guess, to analyze the situation. And people at the top in the federal government knew this and could have sent out an order to do that, couldn't they?
Well, they could have if they'd known that was what had to be done. But there's a couple of factors in here. First of all, planning for big incidents like this is not something you can do at the last minute. Even just look at us today. There's 3 of us here sitting in this radio studio over on Idaho Avenue Northwest giving an interview. In order to get here, Jason had to get in touch with me last week. Asked me, was I willing to do an interview? Yes, I am. Set up a time and day. Tell me where the location was. I had to Google it on a map, find it, and then get over here today and make the plans to be here. If Jason had called me this morning, a half an hour ago and said, Leo, can you do this? I might not have been at home. I might have been someplace else. Things take planning, and this is just for a little radio interview. In the 90s, FEMA spent a lot of time and energy, staff time with our people, meeting with the regional offices, meeting with state and local officials, talking about what are you going to do if there's a big earthquake? What are you going to do if there's a big flood? Making those plans. You want to mobilize buses? Okay, do you have a contract for buses? Do you have a contract for buses? Who's going to pay for the buses? Are the drivers all trained? Are they ready to go? Do they agree they're going to do this? These things, this planning under the Bush administration, unfortunately, after 2001, had really been neglected. The agency was hollowed out. A lot of employees left and weren't replaced. So that planning wasn't being done. So the planning was left for the last minute. And then the people in charge, Michael Chertoff, was a federal judge who used to put criminals in jail. And God bless him for that, but that's not disaster relief. And Mike Brown was a lawyer. And God bless him for that, but that's not disaster relief either. So none of the top people at FEMA or Homeland Security were really trained or ready for their jobs. They hadn't done the planning. So, yeah, things fell apart.
Now, you mentioned you all had put together the reports, though. And, I think it's often lost on people when agencies get kind of hollowed out, is I think the exact way to put it. When you don't fill vacancies where you try to save, 3%, 5% cuts by not filling positions when people leave, you don't have the institutional knowledge to be able to figure this out. But even with the weakened state, that Friday night, and it sounds like that Saturday night, you all put together reports. And I mean, I've seen them there. They're federal government reports that were seen by those folks. The people at the higher levels, they were aware of this, weren't they not?
Well, they received the reports. Whether or not they understood them, I can't see inside their heads. I really don't know if they did. My inclination is to say that they didn't. I don't believe that Michael Chertoff or Michael Brown intentionally left people to die in New Orleans, but they were just in jobs that they weren't qualified for.
Well, what were in these reports? Let's explain, because how would they know? What kinds of things did you tell them?
Well, let me dig into my be a paper shuffling bureaucrat here for a second, and dig into my file folder. These reports is called the National Situation Report, and they're available. You can see them online. You go to www.fema.gov and hit a bunch of buttons, and you can find them. They aren't secret or classified or anything. These are reports that go every day to the bosses at the government agencies, including FEMA and Homeland Security. They are meant to be the morning news for these folks at 5:30 a.m. to tell them the urgent stuff of what's going on. They're short. They're only about 4 pages long, and they stress the first item on the first page every time is whatever, if there's a major threat, that's the first thing mentioned. We go into some details on it, and then after that, we give a little bit of details about other things going on around the country. In this particular one, looking at Saturday morning, that I'm holding in my hand here, Saturday morning, 5:30 a.m., August 27th, 2005, the headline, category becomes a Category 3 hurricane, aims toward northern Gulf Coast. It shows a picture from the National Weather Service of this thing zeroing in with New Orleans being the bullseye 48 hours ahead of time. Shows a picture of people on the next page trying to push a stalled car out of some water because they're already getting rains down there. And then it lists the preparedness that's going on that at this point is pretty limited. Well, we stood up an operations center. We've called in some staff, but there's nothing major in here about warehouses full of food being prepared or water or medicine or anything. But this is basically their warning. It's letting them know, fellas, there is a major disaster coming your way, and you better get cranking on this.
And I saw that even in the next day's report, you all kind of stepped it up a bit. When did FEMA the first start really hitting the ground with the resources that were necessary? I mean, you say this, the Monday was when the storm really hit. And I remember watching the news, and it seemed like the federal government took days to get there.
They did. They did. And that, again, is because of poor planning. Now, there were some federal people who were there. Some individuals got in. Marty Behemond, who was a very brave guy, one of the executive people, I think he was one of the public affairs people at FEMA, he was down there personally in the dome in there when the victims were all there urgently trying to get FEMA headquarters to move on this. And as I recall, one of his emails back to headquarters that got publicized said he had just finished his MRE that he was lucky to have from the military, some military people. He had just gone to the bathroom along with 200 of his closest friends, and he was ready to take his nice sleep on the concrete floor. Could somebody please get some help down for these people? And he didn't get much of an answer. I'm looking at some notes here. I think that, the hurricane occurred on Monday. Chung, 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 chung. On Thursday, supplies began coming in by helicopter. There are still too few for the disaster. Tuesday, Wednesday, I think it was about 48 hours later, some medical teams and some search and rescue teams were there. There were some Army personnel there, but I keep saying the word some. We did have some people down there, but not to the scale of this disaster. They'd rescue people off rooftops or out of the water, but then where are they going to go? They'd stick them on some highway overpass or something and say, well, there you are, folks. You're not drowning anymore. God bless you. You're just dehydrated, no water, no food, no medicine, no place to sleep, nothing to eat. But at least you're not drowning. So some of the people could be rescued from drowning and then die from dehydration.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFG's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com. Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. you'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Leo Bosner, the former president of AFGE's FEMA Local 4060. We were talking about Katrina and what was going on and how it took several days, really, for anybody to, in large numbers, kind of show up. And I'm really struck by the fact that your first introduction to government was in the 101st Airborne. I mean, and you mentioned what happened also with the federal building in Oklahoma City. I mean, the response was right away. It was days and days before the federal government really got off the ground. What do you attribute that to?
Well, it's planning. You have to plan these things. If you're going to run a fire department, you can't wait until the fire breaks out to go out and buy some red trucks. You've got to plan these things ahead of time. You've got to train people ahead of time so that when the emergency occurs, you can hit the ground running and move quickly. This was done very well during the 1990s because James Witt, our director, then understood this. During the 2000s, would we call it, after 2001, that understanding fled. FEMA was de-emphasized, and a lot of the planning activities just really fell apart. I'll mention very briefly, we were talking before about losing staff, and, well, what does this really mean when you lose staff? Okay, when FEMA came under Homeland Security in 2003, we began to see that someone would leave FEMA or retire or whatever, and we couldn't hire a replacement. We'd be told, oh, no, Homeland Security needs that money. They need to hire somebody over there. So I was working in the office at the time that did federal response planning. We were the ones who were supposed to write the national response plan and weren't allowed to. We had a staff of 10 people and a very sharp guy, a very sharp GS-15, who was our boss. And then one of our people retired, and after she left, we couldn't replace her. Suddenly the money had disappeared, so now we had a 9-person office instead of a 10-person office. Then someone else left, and we had an 8-person office and then a 7-person office. And as this went on, of course, the workload got heavier, and those who were left were more and more incentivized to leave. Eventually, by the time of Hurricane Katrina, as I recall it, FEMA had one staff person who was doing this federal response planning. She used to work late every night and come in weekends and everything. She was GS-13, I think. She had contractors she could call upon if their company approved to do some work for her. But we'd gone from a 10-person office down to a 1-person office. So there goes your planning.
And you became ultimately involved in AFGE and your local. Was that some of the reason that led to your getting more involved?
Well, yeah, because we had the same exact situation back in the 80s and 90s. Where FEMA was putting so much of its effort on what to do in case of a nuclear Soviet nuclear attack, and almost no effort for natural disasters. And so I helped establish our union in the early 1990 or 91, I think it was. And as president, I wound up testifying in front of Senator Mikulski and some people in Congress on the problems at FEMA. And they took some actions and changed FEMA's budget to remedy these problems. But, of course, it came down pretty hard on me. I was very nearly fired. They tried to get me out the door. But luckily for me, Bill Clinton won the election in 92, so my job was safe, and I stayed on in FEMA and stayed active in the union.
And this certainly doesn't sound like when people think of unions wanting more pay or better benefits. I mean, this was actually talking about planning for the security of our nation in natural disasters. I mean, that was what the local was doing under your leadership.
Most of the people, and this is interesting, at FEMA, at least during the 90s, the employees were so highly motivated. On Friday, it used to be casual dress day, and the secretaries, the GS-4s and the GS-5s, would come in wearing their FEMA jackets. It was like you were in high school or something like that. People were so proud to work at FEMA, and they were motivated to try to fulfill the mission. And so in the union, when I was union president, we certainly had issues of grievances, but a large part of our work really was devoted toward, number one, was health and safety issues, making sure that disaster workers weren't injured on the job by the neglect of their bosses. And number two was trying to support the mission better. We believed in the mission of FEMA. All of us did, and we didn't want to see it being trashed by a bunch of political appointees.
And functionally, really, as I hear this, I mean, you're almost a poster child for whistleblowing. I mean, in what you did and bringing forth information that nobody would have known otherwise. I mean, if you were investigating this or if you're looking back as a historian, I mean, but for the reports that you created and but for your speaking out, nobody would know that the agency did actually know about this, was aware, and did let the higher level folks know about it. As you contemplate this 5 years later, do you think there's some changes? Maybe whether FEMA should be under the Department of Homeland Security or somehow an independent agency, or what are your thoughts on that looking back?
Well, I'd say that it's hard to separate out. There was, frankly, I hate to sound political, there was a general incompetence within FEMA, within Homeland Security at the top levels during the Bush administration. But there's also the issue of FEMA being under Homeland Security, which I think and a lot of people think is a major mistake. FEMA, if you think of it this way, FEMA is like a fire department. We rescue the victims. Homeland Security is a little bit like a police department. They carry guns and they catch the bad guys. Now, both these jobs are important. They're co-equally important. But if the mayor of Washington was to say tomorrow he's going to put the fire department under the police chief, I think people would be kind of shocked. I don't think Chief Kathy Lanier would be too happy. We don't want to have homicide detectives telling people how to put out fires. But during Hurricane Katrina, when I was a watch officer then, I was a planning section chief actually during the disaster itself, we were just bombarded with telephone calls and demands from Homeland Security. Do this, do that. We need this information. And a lot of it was totally meaningless, and a lot of it was clearly meant for speech writing. If I can give one short example, I worked the night shift, as I mentioned, one of those nights at around 2 o'clock in the morning, I had a call from Homeland Security, and they said that they were looking at our reports and different reports. And one report said, oh, this is about the number of people who have been rescued off rooftops. And maybe it said about that 400 people had been rescued. But another report said that it was 412 people had been rescued. Secretary Chertoff has to know what was the exact number that were rescued. Call down to Florida right now and please wake up those rescuers and get this exact number for us. Now, I happen to know those rescuers. I know a lot of them personally. We're firefighters and medics and so on who've been out there in the water slogging it out for 14 hours, 18 hours, trying to grab a few hours sleep that they badly need. And I'm ordered to call by Homeland Security to call them, wake them up in the middle of the night to get some numbers from Mr. Chertoff. And I'm not allowed to say no. So I had to say, yes, I'll be glad to do it. Okay, I hung the phone up. I waited about 10 minutes. Then I called back to Homeland Security and I said, I'm sorry, with the electrical interference, we can't get through on the phones. We can't get through on the satellite phones. We can't wake anybody up. But we'll keep trying. Oh, my God, Leo, keep trying, keep trying. We need this. Secretary Chertoff needs to know, is it 400 or 412? I said, fine, I hung the phone up. And they went on to something bigger and better. I never woke those rescuers. Forget it. Those people needed their sleep. But this was happening constantly. In fact, I'll mention Bobby Block, who I think you're talking to later. The title of his book is Hurricane Katrina and the Failure of Homeland Security. Not the failure of FEMA, the failure of Homeland Security. We don't belong in Homeland Security. FEMA should be an independent agency.
And let's talk a little about the situation on the ground. I mean, FEMA has been certainly criticized for the response, and obviously the political folks. I mean, I saw some of the emails about what suit to wear and how did I look on an interview and things like that with Michael Brown. But for the folks like you and the folks that you worked with who are, you know, rank and file folks, the people that were out there rank and file, they seem to be doing a pretty good job and people seem to be pretty proud of what they did. Give us some examples of what the FEMA folks on the ground were actually doing.
Well, when FEMA activates, we activate our own people, and we also activate people from and coordinate people from other federal agencies who are out there. So FEMA sends out search and rescue teams, for example, who are actually firefighters from fire departments, and they rescue people off the rooftops. Back at FEMA headquarters, and this is where I work, so this is what I can really see what's going on, our people come in and work 12-hour shifts for sometimes, I say, for 2 months at a time, from 7 to 7 daytime, 7 to 7 nighttime. Gathering information, running all over the place, getting information and reports to support the executives and support these operations. We have other people out in the field after the disaster takes place who will drive around. I've been on this kind of duty in 2004 in Florida. We call it community relations, where we drive around often in very flooded and mosquito-laden areas, contacting people, making sure people are all right, going and knocking on doors of houses that look like they might be neglected. Is anybody in there okay? Has anybody seen you? Do you need a doctor? Do you need any food or medicine? And then reporting that back to the authorities. So, yeah, I think that most female employees traditionally have been very proud of the work they do and are very disappointed at not getting the kind of leadership they should have had under the Bush administration and, frankly, a little bit disappointed about the leadership they have now.
And do you think the over-reliance on contractors creates a problem, too? I mean, we talked a little about that with the problem that you don't have the institutional knowledge. But, I mean, can contractors be mobilized as fast as the employees that are there on the ground and are ready to go and have been trained?
Well, I do think there are problems. And I'll say, starting right off, I've had contractors working for me who did excellent work. A lot of them are fine people. They do fine work. I'm not blaming the individuals. But if you have a federal employee, if you have a GS-12 who's carrying a FEMA ID badge, you can say to that person, look, you pack your bags, you'll be on the plane tonight, you've got to fly to such and such a place. You can't necessarily do that with a contract company. They don't have the same protections, whatever authorities you want to talk about. It's not the same thing. The second thing that happens, institutional knowledge does disappear with contractors. And one of the things these contracting companies have done, and I've seen this firsthand, is they will rotate people through. And it seems to me they're trying to get their people trained by FEMA at FEMA's expense, that during the disaster, they'll give us some contract people to work. And this happened during Katrina. I had people working for me under contract. They worked a few nights. They were doing a great job. I spent a lot of time with them. I explained to them what we do, how we do it, wrote the reports. Then I come in the next night. Oh, no, he got reassigned. I'm here now. Can you show me how we do this, please? So we essentially, on my federal pay as a GS-14, I was training a continuing rotation of contract employees who their company could then bill as having all this expertise, whether it hurt the disaster relief effort as well. Like I guess that's secondary to the company's profits. And then finally, the money is involved. I did find out that a great many of the contract employees, I don't know what their salaries are, but their company billing to FEMA is billed at GS-15 salary or higher. And everybody out there in radio land knows that if you're a working non-supervisor, you're maybe a GS-11, maybe 9, maybe a 12 or a 13. I was a 14. So the taxpayers are paying for a bunch of GS-15 salaries when they could have hired GS-11s or GS-9s or GS-12s.
So looking towards the future, what do you think the Obama administration could be doing as we come into our last minute?
Well, I think the Obama administration needs to pay more attention to FEMA and needs to give it, I think they need to get it out of the Department of Homeland Security. And over at FEMA, I think that Mr. Fugate, the administrator, has to pay more attention to what's happening inside the agency. I've talked to a number of my former colleagues over there, and basically most people feel that either it's the same as before or that it's gotten worse. One employee said to me that it's like a car, FEMA's like a car coasting down a hill with nobody at the steering wheel. And everything's fine so far, but somebody better take the wheel soon. And the other employee put it much more succinctly, and that employee just said, it's Mike Brown all over again. So I think that somebody has to pay attention to what's happening within FEMA.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jim Aldridge, the Secretary-Treasurer of AFGE's Federal Law Enforcement Steering Committee. Welcome back to Inside Government. Talking about Katrina and what happened 5 years ago, and as a police officer for the VA and an AFGE activist, you were sent down to the VA Medical Center in New Orleans during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Can you tell us a little about your experiences?
Sure. I was deployed down to New Orleans to our medical center 3 days after Katrina hit, and I think within a few hours of the dam breaking, or the levee breaking, and we basically had to go to the medical center and secure the servers. We had some staff that we had to evacuate and basically secure the hospital.
Now, where are you based normally?
Orlando, Florida, at the Orlando VA.
And when did you get the order to go to New Orleans?
The day of the storm, they were requesting, because they had seen some of the aftermath, and they lost communications with the medical center itself. So they put out a call for volunteers while the storm was still going on, I believe. And our facility, we had seven officers from our facility that stepped up to the plate and volunteered.
Now, the call came from the VA, or did it come from FEMA, or where did the call to get folks to go down there come from?
It came through the Office of Security and Law Enforcement and to the individual medical centers.
Okay. And how long did it take for you all to get there? I mean, did you go like that day?
We left 3 days later. We had to go to Alexandria, Louisiana first. We staged there, and then we did a convoy from Alexandria down to New Orleans.
And what was it like? What do you remember about that experience?
Well, I remember when we first got there, of course, seeing the windows blown out and all the damage. They were still in parts of the city, anywhere from 6 to 10 feet of water in places. It basically looked like a war zone. You would never know that it was a major U.S. city just because it was deserted and windows blown out and just all kinds of debris. Buildings had collapsed. There was bricks in the roadways. Some walls had collapsed on vehicles. There's bodies floating in the water. There was all kinds of stuff floating in the water. And we had to be transported by a very large military vehicle in order to get to the VA because it was surrounded by water.
Now, you know, when I listened to you, you said it took about 3 days to get from the staging area down there. Were you guys...
It didn't take 3 days to get from the staging area down there. It took just the driving time, which I believe was about 6 hours.
So you drove...
We didn't leave our facility for 3 days after the call went out.
And why was that, if you know?
As far as I know, they were still trying to get organized. They didn't know what we were getting into because they lost communications. So they didn't know what the conditions were actually in New Orleans. So they were basically trying to get communications established, and they were trying to get supplies and just get organized, period.
And what kind of things do you think could have been done better?
I think back then there should have been more things done beforehand. There should have been, teams on call or on standby prior to the storm. That way, as soon as the storm let up, we could have been, just outside of the storm range area and we could have moved in a lot quicker.
Did it seem like there was adequate coordination between all the agencies that were working there?
Not as far as I could tell, no. I would have to say no.
And do you think
there was many different agencies down there. In fact, nobody knew we were there, and we actually got raided by New Orleans SWAT on the Wednesday, the first Wednesday we were down there. SWAT team came in not knowing that there were federal police officers there.
And when you say the SWAT team came in when you were at the VA Medical Center?
They had gotten a report from one of the National Guard units that was doing patrols of the city. They had gotten a report that there was armed individuals at the VA. And, of course, the armed individuals were the police officers on patrol.
Now, how long were you down there?
We were in New Orleans for 8 days. We were deployed for a total of 12 days.
And how did the people of New Orleans react to seeing you and your colleagues as you were coming in?
As we were coming in, it was kind of strange because in certain areas of the city, it was cheers, standing ovations, people clapping, things of that nature. But in other parts of the city that we went through, it was people desperate for supplies and stuff. And I don't know if they realized that we were going down for security purposes or if they thought we were bringing them supplies, but they were trying to rush the convoy. And, of course, we could hear gunfire off in the distance.
Now, I remember during that time the union was getting a lot of phone calls from folks that had been displaced and trying to see what we had to try to help with folks, and there was a lot going on. I mean, the Union Plus credit card was helping a lot of people, and there were a lot of programs and things like that. Talk about some of the good that came out of Hurricane Katrina, if there was any. Was there anything positive that came out of this experience for you?
I believe so. One of the changes, in fact, we the first couple of days we were there, we were running low on fuel for the emergency generator for the medical center, and the tank for the fuel was underneath the parking lot. Well, of course, above the parking lot is about 4 foot of water. So we had a tanker that came to put fuel in it, but it was underground, and they couldn't get to it. So we jury-rigged a fan shroud, one of those big industrial fan shrouds, placed it over the opening for the fuel tank, pumped the water out with a wet dry vac, and sandbagged around the fan shroud, and we were able to keep the water at bay long enough for them to pump about 50,000 gallons of fuel into the underground tank so we didn't lose an emergency generator. Since then, a lot of the VAs, if not all of them, have started to remove the tanks from underground and keep them above ground.
And, you know, as you had that experience down there, I mean, what was going on with the actual veterans that the VA was taking care of? Were they evacuated in time? Were there problems around that?
I can only speak for the New Orleans, yes. All of the VA patients at the New Orleans complex were evacuated, according to what I was told, prior to the storm hitting. There was a couple of bedridden ones that we weren't able to evacuate until after the storm, but they were given priority, and they were out within 48 hours.
And what did you learn from this experience?
The need to be prepared. That was one thing. We had lost communications. We had no idea what we were getting into. There was no... we would have had no food if it hadn't been for the Superdome. They were transferring everybody out of the Superdome, and they had a lot of MREs left. When we went down there, we only took a couple of days' worth of food, and we would have ran out of food, but we managed to get the MREs that were left over from the Superdome. It was hit or miss communication-wise. So that made it very difficult to find out what was going on, when relief was coming, when supplies were coming, things of that nature. So it's definitely something that needs to be in place before a storm hits, not trying to organize things afterwards.
And do you think that if you have a lot of contracts and contractor folks, that may be more difficult to mobilize than, say, as you were as a federal employee? You know, you're there every day. They can just say, okay, you know, in 2 days you're going and off you're gone. If you had to mobilize a contractor workforce, you think that would be more difficult in your opinion?
In my opinion, yes, most definitely. Because a lot of times you have to deal with the company, not directly with the employee. You know, with federal employees, do like they did, exactly what they did. They asked for volunteers. They had more than enough volunteers step up to the plate. We were rotating people out. Originally, we were told to expect to be deployed for a minimum of 30 to 60 days. Because the conditions were so bad and there were so many employees that volunteered, they were able to rotate us out every 7 to 10 days.
And do you think we're better off now than we were then? Or is there ongoing training that's taking place? Or do you feel like maybe we've dropped the ball and there's a need to pick it up?
I think we're better off than what we were. But I also feel that there's a lot of room for improvement. I still don't think we're where we need to be at just yet. But we're definitely better than we were back then.
Now, you know, there's been a lot of debate, particularly with the TSOs, about unions impacting national security and that sort of thing. Obviously, this was a natural disaster, a national disaster. What do you see coming from that? What was your opinion in terms of how the union, both at your local level and nationally, responded to the situation?
Local, we got all kinds of support at the local level. Had a couple of minor issues with policy and everything, but it was within our director's control to eliminate. For example, I had requested in advance in order to get supplies, needed supplies, such as toiletries, water, Gatorade, battery chargers, batteries, flashlights, things of that nature. And when I came back, of course, they were told, oh, you got to pay all that back. You got to pay all that back. I wasn't authorized. And I said, well, I told you in advance what I was using the money for, and you gave it to me. And once I appealed to the director of the facility, he says, no, you don't have to pay that back. That was needed supplies. It wasn't like it was luxury items or anything to that nature. So I got a lot of support at the local level. National level, union-wise, we got a lot of support from. National VA, again, a lot of red tape. We should have gotten what they call hazardous duty pay, and they gave it to us only for the hours that we were considered on duty, even though our off-duty living situation was identical because we were being housed at the VA. And our environmental status was the same as it was when we were on duty, but they were only paying us for on-duty hours versus the off-duty, and we should have been 24/7 portal-to-portal pay, which they never gave us.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Vinnie DeMarco, the president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative and the subject of a new book, The DeMarco Factor. Welcome back to Inside Government, Vinnie.
Hey, how you doing, Ward?
Good. So tell me a little about this new book, The DeMarco Factor. You got a whole book about yourself now.
Well, the book is about our strategy that have been successful in expanding health care and achieving other public health goals over some very strong and powerful special interest opposition. And the book gives some good lessons that advocates can learn from in how to accomplish these goals.
So as a later-day Saul Alinsky, tell us a little about your strategies.
Well, the subtitle of the book, and the book is called The DeMarco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power. And the subtitle really says it all. We work on issues where there's very strong popular support. Polling shows overwhelming 70% majorities. But again, powerful interests. The tobacco issue is a good one, where overwhelming majority of people want to increase cigarette tax, reduce teen smoking. But the tobacco companies make money when more cigarettes are sold, of course, and they oppose it. So how do you overcome that? And the book describes our strategy, which starts with a simple idea of, okay, let's ignore the policymakers for a while and talk to the people who support these proposals and get broad support. And we come up with a document we call our resolution that outlines why we need to move these policies and how it would work. And whereas teen smoking kills and tobacco tax increase save lives, resolve, the undersigned organization supports a tobacco tax increase. And then we go out and get hundreds of organizations to endorse it, and by the time we're done with that process, we've got a powerful coalition. And then we use the media to get the message out about this growing coalition. We hold press conferences with faith leaders and community leaders and labor and business leaders. We go on radio shows like yours, and we get the message out about how strong this coalition is. And then we make it an issue in an election. At an election time, like we're going through in Maryland right now, we ask candidates to endorse this proposal. Now, we don't endorse candidates, but we ask them to endorse the same proposal that the people endorse through these organizations. And this year, we're doing that on a dime a drink alcohol tax increase that over 140 candidates for Maryland General Assembly have endorsed. And then we really push to get them to endorse it, and our coalition partners urge people to endorse it. By the time we're done with that process, we've overcome the powerful vested interest opposition and are ready to enact, whether it's a one-gun-a-month law to reduce gun violence, or a dollar increase in the cigarette tax, or expansion of health care, or requiring big companies like Walmart to provide health care, or now a dime a drink increase in alcohol tax. So that's a thumbnail sketch of our process, but you can really get a good view of it by going to Amazon.com or your local bookstore and picking up the book and checking it out.
Now, of course, I've been observing the DeMarco factor for, oh gosh, almost 30 years. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems like one of the first places you usually start is with persons of faith and the faith community.
Yes.
Talk a little about that for us.
Well, I have found that for four important reasons, faith leaders can play a critical role in moving public health issues. Number one, faith leaders have a moral authority that policymakers have to listen to them. They don't always do what they say, of course, but they have to listen. They have the voice that has to be listened to. Second, that is where the grassroots is, particularly when I was working on the gun issue, we had a situation where there were gun shops where people came in and did their grassroots work stuff against us. When you work with the faith community, you have these church basements, these synagogues, these mosques where people are gathered, and they can write the letters, make the calls, go to the rallies, and really build your grassroots power. Third, diversity. Movements like ours, you build broad diversity, both religious, political, racial, economic, and social diversity in really reaching out to so many people through the faith community. And finally, media. The media loves covering the faith community, taking on whether it's the gun lobby or the tobacco companies or healthcare interests. It's like a David and Goliath scene. When we had a press conference ward on a tobacco tax in 1998 and we had all these top faith leaders, the head of the United Methodist Church said he wanted to kick the butts of the tobacco companies. And he was livid when that wasn't in the paper. He wanted that in the paper. But we did have the Lutheran leader saying that for years the Lutherans have made fun of the Methodists and the Baptists for getting so excited about tobacco, and I'm here to say the Methodists are right and we are wrong and we're going to work with you. And all that resulted in a front-page article in the Baltimore Sun, clerics back, tobacco tax increase, and that night in the news on the clipping it said, God versus tobacco. You can't beat that. And that's what resulted in our coalition being so powerful. And on everything I've worked on, the faith community has been core.
So with God on your side, have you found it difficult to get, as you're kind of mentioning, all the different faith-based groups together? Or do you find that actually on these kinds of issues, regardless of faith, that it becomes relatively similar getting them together?
Well, it's a good question, and it depends on the issue. And, you know, the vast majority of the faith community really believes in the public health goals we've set out. Let me give you an example. On the tobacco issue, I've worked nationally on the group called Faith United Against Tobacco. I'm the national coordinator. And you can find out about it at faithagainsttobacco.org. And this group brought together some of the most liberal faith groups in the country, like the Unitarians and the United Church of Christ, and some of the most conservative, the Southern Baptists, who disagreed on many other things but came together to save lives by reducing smoking. And this was very, very powerful. In fact, when Henry Waxman from California, lead sponsor of legislation in the House, took it to the House floor, he said, "This coalition brings together everybody from the Sikhs to the Southern Baptists," and that kind of broad coalition really, really helps.
Now, in terms of working with labor, you know, some of these issues are a little bit beyond wages and working conditions. How have you found working with unions around these issues?
It's a good question, and you know, clearly on health care, labor is right there and critical. When we work to require big companies like Walmart to provide health care, labor was lead, and labor really, really pushed as part of our coalition with large businesses who are on our side. On other issues, some labor unions are more interested than others. On reducing smoking, we had a lot of support from AFSCME, 1199, and some other unions. No union opposed us, but some weren't as aggressively involved. But labor understands that we all benefit when there's less people sick by expanding health care or reducing smoking, and labor very, very strongly supports measures that keep people healthy.
Now, in many ways, people have always said on both parties that the states are where some of the action can be, at least in terms of new ideas and new thinking. In the health care area, you're obviously a leader in health care in Maryland. What are some of the new ideas and new thinking?
Well, you know, we have over the last 4 years in Maryland, under the leadership of Governor Martin O'Malley, expanded health care to over 200,000 uninsured parents, children, and seniors. And it's worked because we've done it in a financially reasonable way, fiscally reasonable way. We expanded tobacco tax by $1 per pack. That caused 74 million fewer packs of cigarettes to be sold and made Maryland's sixth lowest smoking rate in the country, and raised $120 million, which helped to fund the health care expansion. So we've been at the cutting edge of showing that you can use public health measures like tobacco tax to help fund the health care that we need to fund. Now we're trying to do that by increasing the alcohol tax by dime a drink, which will also save lives by reducing underage drinking and alcohol abuse. So we've been at the cutting edge of showing that there are public health ways that you can raise the money to expand health care.
Do you think that we're going to get to the point in some states, and maybe Maryland being one, where we're going to have a state public health option?
It's a good question, and you know, the federal health reform gave states a lot of leeway in figuring that out. And we have the Governor O'Malley did a great job in creating a coordinating council, which any Marylander can chime in on through healthreform.maryland.gov. And this coordinating council is a transparent and open way for organizations like ours and individual Marylanders, unions and businesses, to let their voices be heard. And there's a subgroup working on what our healthcare exchange is going to be about. And there are people pushing for a public option in there. There are people pushing for making sure the exchange is strong enough to keep premiums down as low as possible. And we're going to be right in there making sure that Maryland's exchange is the best possible. One of the things that we feel is very, very important is that the exchange be brought, that it be one exchange, including individuals, small businesses, and everyone else together, and that's the best way you get the best bargaining power when you're trying to lower insurance premiums.
And with some of the big businesses, are you finding that they're coming around on this thing, or are they still trying to fight it, hoping they'll go back after the next election?
Well, we found when we were working on our proposal to allow large companies to provide health care coverage, big businesses like Giant Food came out there and fought hard with us to get that enacted. That was declared invalid because of federal preemption. But now the company that we were trying to make sure provided health care, Walmart, this year endorsed the Obama proposal that required large companies to provide health care. So they've come a long way, and I think what we did in Maryland helped bring them along. I don't see the large business community fighting to repeal health reform. I see them trying to implement it properly.
And what about small businesses? It seems like this would be an opportunity for them to be able to get affordable health care for their employees that they would care about. But are they feeling like maybe this is too costly, or they're not buying in on some level?
There are unfortunately some groups that are bringing lawsuits to declare the law invalid, and I don't understand that because the new law provides tax credits for small businesses up to 25 employees that will substantially lower their health care costs. In fact, one of our goals right now, and you can check this out at our website, healthcareforall.com, is to find these businesses and make sure they know that these benefits are out there. And there are also grants under the Maryland Governor O'Malley's health care law also. So small businesses in Maryland can find substantial breaks on getting health care. One of the things that I wanted to emphasize is that there are human faces behind these numbers that I gave earlier of 200,000 people getting health care coverage. And we just put out a new book called Faces of Maryland's Newly Insured, which has 40 wonderful stories of people who've benefited in Maryland.
And we want to say thank you to our guests this week, AFGE FEMA Local President Leo Bosner, AFGE Federal Law Enforcement Steering Committee Secretary Treasurer Jim Aldridge, and Vinnie DeMarco, the president of Maryland Citizens Health Care Initiative and also the subject of the new book, The DeMarco Factor. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.